You're listening to Arsenal Pass, a flesh and blood podcast for players by players, and all about strategy, leveling up, and the latest news in the world of Wraith. Welcome to Arsenal Pass.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Arsenal Pass episode 160. Head down here with Brendan Patrick. Brendan, I heard you've been winning some stitches.
Yeah, the Lurkana thing. It was fun. It was kind of like the first season of Road to Nats. Not because I won, but because of just like that was the aura of it. You know, it's like it's the most competitive event for that game right now. Everybody's into it, so it's all good vibes. Games are like that. And then, you know, somewhere down the line, 4 or 5 years, everyone gets angry and mad at each other. I'm joking. But yeah, unfortunately, I think that I'm still sick. For a guy that never gets sick, I've kind of been sick.
You've been
a lot.
Sick a lot.
Yeah. So what happened is I got sick. I got better. Then I kind of started to feel bad again. And then I kind of started to feel better and I started antibiotics. And then I was like 2 days in and I just started feeling bad again. And like even last night on top of that, I got back home from one of these events, which was like 12 hours. I ate something that had maybe been in the fridge for too long. So I got food poisoning on top of that. So like was yakking all last night. And yeah, I woke up today just feeling like garbage, like coughing up all the stuff and, you know, my throat hurts. So I think I pushed myself a little too hard. So like, despite being sick, I still was like going to the gym every day. I felt like after I had the grace period, after I thought I wasn't contagious after like 7 days, and then I was playing these events, which is like 12, 14 hour tournaments. And I think it actually, I don't know, maybe that's what my girlfriend says. She's like, you got to stop going to the gym. I'm like, no, I'm not. I can't. What are you doing? Cause she's like, obviously this is happening. You're pushing yourself too hard. And, while I don't agree, maybe that's the cause. Maybe that's the cause. But yeah, I feel god awful today. Actually,
it might be the 24 hours of all kind of events as well.
Yeah. just gaming. Yeah, it was interesting. It was fun to do. Like I said, it's the same kind of aura you had in Flesh and Blood during that first like Road to National PQ like calling season. I don't know. The energy is electric. Also, I guess card game enjoyability is directly correlated to winning. So maybe I'm just on a heater right now. So maybe that's why I'm liking it, is because I won a bit.
I picked up some Lorcana cards while I was in.
What's up with you? You look different. You look a little spiffed today. You got that nice shirt on. You're showing a little chest cleavage there, a little neck cleavage.
Well, I'm sitting in a hotel room in Framingham, Massachusetts. So
yeah, is it cold or is it warm now?
No, it's nice here. I went actually it's beautiful here. I'm in, I guess, kind of Massachusetts near New England area, right? So it's beautiful here. I went for a nice run this morning. I saw squirrels.
There's something about Australia. Dude, every Australian that's come to Texas I've taken outside lost their shit when they saw a squirrel.
We don't have them.
Yeah, there's a million in Texas, so I'm just so used to seeing them. But yeah, you guys love squirrels.
That's like when you guys come here and you see kangaroos. When you come to Sydney and you go, kangaroos. We go, wow, we see them all the time.
That's a crazy animal, though. They're like little people, right? They're like jacked and they've got the arms and they might punch you and stuff. Like a squirrel is like a little rodent. A kangaroo is like, it's like a teenage, like an angry teenager.
Yeah, they kind of look like you.
Yeah, I mean, hey. I'll take it as a compliment. Those guys are they're stacked.
Yeah. No, I've been traveling. Do you know what? So, you know, I'm notorious for not getting jet lagged.
You're jet lagged?
But I found the thing that breaks me. Traveling through three time zones in a week definitely breaks me. So we recorded early last week so we could get a pod out. Mm-hmm. And I was in the UK and now I'm in the US and been working a lot.
Yeah,
it's taking its toll. So
you're also over the hump. Like you're almost in your sort of, I forget what they call it, like the second half of your life. You're almost there. You know, you're cresting the hill per se.
Man, I'm 30. Anyway, we've got a pod for you today. We're going to talk about, look, we're in, unfortunately, I didn't end up getting to play a ProQuest this season. I planned to maybe play one when I was here in Boston, but just didn't line up. So didn't get to play a ProQuest this season, but been a lot of interesting stuff happening this ProQuest season with a lot of interesting decks that have been winning, Brendan. I don't know if you've been keeping abreast of this, but a lot of interesting strategies.
Yeah, I saw the Prism stuff. That definitely...
we've moved past that now, though.
I know. I've seen some of the other discourse. I don't really go, like, peruse the online discourse as much, but yeah, it looks pretty spicy. One interesting thing that happened recently is like my local game. My local game store. The local game store I played Fab at the most, that was the first store that introduced me into the game, Reaper Game Store in Denton. Mm-hmm. Their Flesh and Blood events actually don't fire anymore. It's probably not happening in APAC, but the reason that's happening is because they put Star Wars on the same night, Star Wars Unlimited. But like, I think it's that like conjunction of being out of season plus these new games coming out. So I'm wondering, and I want to pose a question to the audience, if that's been happening anywhere else in the US. I assume it's not happening in APAC because APAC is not serviced for some of these other new games. But Reaper is like one of those stores I would have never thought wouldn't fire. Because like Reaper is, I think it's one of the first game stores that ever actually held Flesh and Blood. Like it was the OG store. In the US, it got me into the game.
Yeah, and they ran the first calling, right? Well, one of the first callings.
They didn't run it, no. So that was down in Austin, but they like, I guess they brought like a team out there and like 10 guys. Okay. But you know, it's a 30 player tournament. You bring 10 people, it's a pretty big team. It's kind of like the Wolfpack in a modern pro tour.
RIP. Yeah, well, I mean, Lorcana not in Australia, but One Piece has definitely been having an impact on some games for sure. One Piece has been pretty big, and I think Star Wars is down under.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so they have the logistics down in APAC. Yeah, One Piece. What a the only thing I've seen One Piece from outside, and we'll get into the Flesh and Blood stuff. I promise. I've seen it from outside, so I went to a regional once.
We won't.
Just to go, yeah, I know. Just to go hang out with some people, some Flesh and Blood people that are playing One Piece. So I've seen the game from the outside, and my take is that it seems like an okay, like fun game. Seems pretty cool. Actually, pretty similar to Flesh and Blood, to be honest. But getting into tournaments and like the whole structure of their entire organized play program seems like a nightmare. That being said, the prizing and compensation is entirely promo based, but it's insane. Like some of these promo cards are crazy expensive. For any video listeners, they may have seen me just pop out my earphone. Hayden, I had after almost 4 years of podcasting, or 3 years, I don't know where we are. I had the craziest revelation. You ready for it? So I was listening back. I've been listening back to some pods for a while now, and I noticed that I occasionally slur my words. Like at the tail end of a word or something, like it just like, it kind of falls off. I don't finish the word. And I didn't really know why that was happening. And I figured I was just
telling yourself.
Yeah, that's why it was. Cause I was, you know, every time I tried to do a solo video, it was terrible. Like I couldn't do it. I would do like a couple sentences and like it would just, I would always mess it up. And then I finally did one without my earphones and I just went 30 minutes straight and it was like the easiest thing I ever did. And I was like, holy shit, I couldn't hear myself the whole time. My earphones were too canceling. So yeah, it's a big revelation. I just couldn't believe that I went that long.
I could have told you this.
Yeah.
I often drop a headphone out. When I record solo, I don't have headphones at all. So
yeah.
Anyway, come on, Brent. We're going to move on to the Flesh and Blood. People are going to cancel us again. I want to start with the news, and I want to start with these new cards because we've had a couple of cards previewed for the new set, and they look pretty spicy. Like they've clearly, like Alice's have clearly released these cards with a purpose, which is to, you know, I think, shake up a particular couple of heroes, a couple of shadow heroes that have not had the same love maybe as other heroes. I'm going to need you to read these cards for me because the pictures have for some reason become pixelated for me, but we should go over them one by one and you can choose where we start, I guess.
Yeah, so we can start with the Shadow Runeblade card. It's called Eloquent Energy. It's a one cost red pitch. It attacks for 4, blocks for 3. Shadow Runeblade attack action. It has Rune Gate, so if you control Rune Chance, it reduces the cost greater than equals cost. Sorry, it's also pixelated for me. No, there it is. So if you control Rune Chance equal or greater than this card's cost, you may play it from your banish zone without paying its resource cost. And this card says, when the combat chain closes, if a hero lost life this turn, create an Eloquence token. And this card has Blood Debt. And Blood Debt says, when this is in your banish zone, at the beginning of your end phase, lose 1 life. What are your thoughts? I mean, this is like a Vincent card, though. So, like, Vincent is this hero that just basically hasn't existed for me in Flesh and Blood because I know there's some cool combo decks that are floating around, but the TLDR on them was that they were just not powerful enough, so I never really paid them much attention.
Yeah, I mean, I think... How many times have you played against a Vincent?
Zero. Actually, zero.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Actually, zero.
I played against it two different callings, but... So for just quickly for those that don't know, Eloquence Token is a generic token aura. It says when you play a non-attack action card, destroy this and that card gets go again. So Eloquence can really help you generate more actions, right, and play wider combat chains. And I think that's something that, you know, post the Rune Blades of old, thinking Viscerai, Briar, of course, chain, you know, Vincey, obviously a bit more powered back, but Eloquence feels like the key that maybe unlocks some of these kind of crazy big kind of maybe combos, but maybe it's not even combos, maybe it's just big combat chains. And Runegate is obviously really powerful, right? Like some of these cards, I mean, this card in particular is really above rate. You know, I think we haven't seen one cost ones. We've had two costs and three costs, and they hadn't printed one cost Runegate cards, and now they have, and that feels like a really powerful addition. It's only one, right? But that might be all Vincent needs to be able to, with the Eloquence piece of it, be able to unlock some things. So, because you have that other card that creates Eloquence tokens, and it's not really been the card that everyone kind of talked about, that would be the card that would see play, but it's a little bit underrated. It's not really been ideal. It's not how people have played Vincent. And yeah, I think Vincent is, honestly, it's not particularly great. I don't think this one card by itself is going to do the trick, but I think this unlocks some interesting ways for the hero to play. I mean, I think Eloquence tokens clearly are very powerful. And if you take the Eloquence token, you take the rate of this card, you take Runegate into effect, I think that the one cost nature of this card, I think this card is powerful. I just don't know if it's going to be... This is, of the two cards, I'm least interested about this one. I'll tell you what.
Do you think this card is pushed? And we can also ask the question for the next card. But I've been wondering...
Yeah, I think it definitely is.
Okay, yeah. So that's actually interesting. They're using this expansion slot for these, like... Almost like, I mean, this card's not a great example, but what looks to be like power crept ish kind of card sometimes.
It's just like the numbers on it, it definitely is.
Yeah. So, I mean,
yeah, this card's good.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the next one, which is I can never say Levia normally now. I just have to say Levia. Fucking luckily ask her. This one is a Shadow Brute attack action. It costs 2 red pitch, attacks for 6, blocks for 3. And it says, as additional cost to play this, banish 3 random cards from your graveyard. If one or more cards with 6 or more power was banished this way, this gets +1. If 2 or more, this gets go again. If 3 or more, you can play a card banished this way this turn. This card has blood debt. I mean, this card is actually insane, though.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think people... Okay, so there's two sides to this card. People are like, wow, you know, how often do you get this third mode? And it's like, okay, sure. If you don't, then, okay, you get a 2... It costs 2, right? 2 costs 7 attack, go again. Sorry, not go again. What's the second ability?
Yeah, go the again. Second go is go again.
So, yeah, it's go again. So, okay, 2 costs 7, go again. Like, that's just a bit of Dread Screamer at that point, right? But then if you ever unlock that third ability, it's really powerful, obviously, like super, super powerful, like massively above, right? Like super pushed, like you say. And yeah, maybe you could build around this to make sure you always get that third ability, but I don't think that's what's so strong about this card. What is strong about this card is that it is a good utility card. It defends for 3. It costs 2. It does the thing that you want to do, which is extend your combat chain. It does the thing that you need to do when you're leaning into... Because I think people have tried to play Levia and not lean into the hero ability. And honestly, like, I think it's now proven that that's just not the way to do it. Like, it's just at that point, play KO, play Reinhardt, whatever. If you're going to play Levia, you have to lean into it. But that comes with all the baggage of leaning into Levia, right? It's just, how strong is it really? But when you have this card that just has utility, it has redundancy, and also has this really massively high ceiling potential on it, I think this is just the kind of card that this needs. You know, this replaces something like Hungering Slaughter Beast or whatever. But this card is really powerful, not because of that third ability and always being able to consistently turn it on, but what it does is just gives you that extra kind of push, that extra redundancy. So is it enough to make Levia tier 1? I don't know. I think fundamentally this doesn't do anything to fix Levia's problems, but what it does do is gives you just a little bit more consistency with still the overhang of what Levia is and the downsides of it. But that in itself, that little bit of extra consistency might be enough to make it win one more game in a 12-round event, and that might be the difference. Honestly, like Levia is powerful. I'll give Jessica that one. I'll give Michael that one. But it's, you know, I don't think this is solving all the problems, but it's giving you maybe a little bit extra percentage, and that might just be enough because Levia is close. But yeah, I think you've got to lean into what Levia is, which is high power level, but with some high variance that comes with it. And this does do a little bit of reduction in the variance, does give you a bit of, yeah, like I say, that flexibility, but it doesn't solve the issue, so.
Yeah, I mean, we always talk about ceilings and floors on cards, and the floor on this card is relatively good. We're assuming the floor is probably hitting 2, right? Because you want that go again. Where the ceiling
even
is
if it's hitting 1, though, even if it's hitting 1, it's just a hungry slaughter.
It's serviceable, right? Yeah. But the ceiling is actually insane because you don't effectively draw a card, but It's kind of close. You know, you can't use it as a resource card. Well, you can't use it as a resource card. That's the only difference from Flesh and Blood. But it's close. It's very, very close. I think the card is pretty nuts. I'm just surprised this card blocks for three, to be honest.
Yeah. So you actually make it kind of like allude to a pretty good point about the issue with some of these things, which is you said it doesn't create a resource. Like you don't draw the card, you can't pitch it for a resource. And one of the issues with, so basically I think the most powerful decks in Flesh and Blood, whether you look through history, is they have good resource bases. And I think Briar might be kind of the exception to this, but actually its resource bases were non-attack actions that allowed you to create embodiments. So actually it's pretty good. But the problem with like brutes is that often your resources are pretty bad, right? They're like clunky attack actions that kind of do nothing. And Leviar is no exception to that, right? Like you want to play all these six attacks to trigger fulfill all these requirements, but you don't have access to that many six attacks. You have access to like seven, right? As Leviar. So that again, another little issue that still persists is that you want to play a higher blue count, but your blues are really bad. So, I think there's just, I think this card's powerful, but again, it's not solving all the issues that exist with Leviar. So as much as this might look super powerful, it's like, for instance, I think this card looks super powerful, but I think the new Victor specialization is going to have more impact.
I mean, that card, that is the most push card I've seen. That card is nuts. And Victor's got, he checks all the boxes. He's got the strong blues. He's got a consistent resource base. He's got a fridge. He does like he commits like some absolute sins in Flesh and Blood, which is just draw a card. That's like such a hard thing to do in this game, and he does it so easily, or what feels like pretty easily. I just think Victor is, he's coming into his prime soon, but who knows? Victor Prime. Maybe there's some asymmetric decks that gatekeep him, but ultimately, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're gonna talk about some of those.
I know. Yeah. I know we will. All right, let's go Command and Cookout then.
Just quickly, I think last couple of things to cover in the news. We've got, at this point, if you haven't already seen them, we've got a couple of deck techs out that came out through the ProQuest season. I also did one on Reiner, which in the end, we just threw straight up on Patreon. So if you want to get access to this Value Club Reiner deck, you can see that on Patreon. And then, let's go to the Command and Cookout. Do you want to take the question here, Brendan, and read the question out?
All right. The question here is from Bad Whiskey. This comes from YouTube. So if you want to get your question right out, you can choose to come on YouTube for next week. But they say, with how important the draft and sealed experience is to LSS, do you think they will ever release a cube list? Maybe. Like, it depends what you mean by that. If you mean like an official list from like on fabtcg.com, probably is like I could see it happening as like a content thing. Just like, hey, here you go. Don't take it too seriously. But also, I mean, these developers, like they have their own podcast now. So I don't see why not they, wouldn't do something like that. I don't think it's on the priority list per se, but there's no reason to not do something like that.
Yeah.
Flesh and Blood Cube is something that I haven't personally played, but I've just heard it floating around for a long time. A lot of people at these Pro Tour events will, like, oh, I've got my cube. I've got this. We're about to go here in cube. I've never been able to just get into one of those pods for the cubes, but I've heard good things. At this point, my affinity for Flesh and Blood Limited has waned a bit, but I'd be interested to see if that would change at all during like something like a cube draft.
I've played a lot of cube. Whether that be physical cubes or I'm talking Magic the Gathering here, whether it be physical cubes or that be Magic Arena, Magic Online cubes. I really like Cube Draft. I think it's super interesting. I think it's such a cool way to do differences in power level and marry together mechanics from different times, right? I think that poses a lot more of a challenge in Flesh and Blood because of the dynamic of balancing damage, resource cast. Cubes are usually singleton cubes that don't have multiples of cards, but I think in Flesh and Blood you could probably do multiples of cards. I think it's fine, but I think it's harder to balance personally. I think it's gonna be harder to balance in terms of will LSS ever release a official cube list. I think a lot of their formats that they've, so if I think of something like there was like a fan made similar to Blitz, but it was like Blitz, but like commoner Blitz, but it had like some rares.
I know
and
you're talking like, about it. I remember Manson was called. Pushing it, I think.
Yeah, yeah, he was. Ethan was like a big, I think even Ethan might have even come up with it, but basically,
it's
I think
Clash, LSS,
maybe it's called, but I think LSS were like kind of throwing a little bit of potential support behind that. And I think if there's a big community drive, like they will throw support behind those sorts of things, potentially, because they're very community led when it comes to those sorts of things. And I think they will be. But I don't think unless there's a big community driver for those things that they'll see it. And I have seen community cubes and things like that. I think what ultimately could happen is if that cube became a thing through the community, then eventually LSS might be like, okay, well, here we're going to do a cube thing at an event or, but I just can't really see it. They're never going to release an official product, an official list. They don't have an online client like Magic Online to do
it's,
all the
It's really the
cubes
online client. Yeah.
And that's how Magic drove it. So honestly, I think the answer is probably not, but it's not definitely no.
Yeah, I just think at this point, like, it's not content, right? Because there is no online client, like, a cube is just not actual content for the game. While you and your play group might be able to take the list and do something with it and play it in your little, in your small 8-person group, ultimately, it's not like they're not, it's not like a piece of content that they, that would actually like service the players of Flesh and Blood, ultimately. Because like the onus is on you to basically go into your collection, find all the cards, set it up, know how to do it, and then find 7 other people to draft it with you, which I think is a little bit of a stretch. Like if there was an online client, maybe that would be a different story. I'm interested. Honestly, this brings up even another topic, but it's a tangent, so I'm just going to say it and then we'll not talk about it. But I'm interested in Flesh and Blood is thinking about like online clients and things like that, because I don't know. I just think that at this point, it's weird. You know, with a lot of these new games coming out and then having more fleshed out online clients in something like Talishar, so that you can like pair with people with better ease and like they have these like rank systems. It's just a lot more engaging. And I would say, honestly, I would honestly say this for Lorcana, like I think the game would have been infinitely smaller if they didn't have that. And they have like one of the best online clients I've ever seen, and the game is super accessible.
But they didn't make that, right? Isn't
no,
that,
they
isn't
didn't.
That fan made?
Yeah, but they yeah. they let yeah, yeah that guy. But that I know that guy who made that, and he would love to make one for Flesh and Blood, but he can't because Flesh and Blood is actually more strict than Ravensburger is around that stuff. And you know, when they took down Draft Fab, but I think that that client in particular has pushed the game farther. Then, like, I honestly think the game would have been close to DOA because of the product issues. Like, maybe it would have came back because it's Disney. But ultimately, like, the game was not very playable in its beginning state. And it still is. And, like, APAC, you can't really get it. And that client, like, people, they're doing, like, 100,000 games a week, bro. Like, it's insane. Yeah, wow. I would love to see something like that for Flesh and Blood because, like, for me, especially when engaging with a game like, that game for me is free to play. But when I want to go play physical events, it's when I buy the cards. And it's just been like such a good experience so far. And it's just, for me, it's just way, way better than Talishar. And I wonder if Flesh and Blood would ever go that route. But you can also go that route in terms of they make their own client and they make it not free to play. I'd be okay with that. I'd be okay with paying for a Flesh and Blood digital client. I wonder what the future is because it does seem like Legend Story is interested in, you know, pushing their bottom line, like they said it in their interview.
Making
a billy, road to a billy, baby. Digital is a way to do that. So I wonder if they've changed the strategy at all.
Honestly.
Yeah. We've seen them change a lot of strategy, right? I mean, we have over at least, I believe, it's like a product every month coming out, right? That's completely antithetical.
Because of the Armory Dicks, yeah.
That's completely antithetical to what they said at the beginning. Like their whole initial pitch was like, we are not Magic, no product fatigue. Now it's like product, which is, you can dog on them for being incongruent or changing the strategy or maybe just growing as a company. But for me, I think it's a better thing. I think it's better. I'd rather have more content than not. But along the lines of that, I wonder if they're willing to change the strategy around digital as well. I have no dog in that race. I don't care what they do. But it's an interesting thought experiment. I mean, I just like, I'm not going to sit here and defend people in the comments being like Flesh and Blood would die if there was a digital or like the best thing about this game is that it's not digital. Like I'm not trying to defend it. Right. So like, what I'm trying to say is I don't have a dog in the race. I do think it would be potentially better for the game, but I'm more interested to look at it from an outside perspective and just like, are they willing to actually change the strategy on this super fundamental, to the game's core pitch, which was absolutely no digital presence. Because let's be real, whether you like it or not, Flesh and Blood is a digital game right now. It's just super inefficient and clunky.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to get questions for the Commander Cookout.
Yeah, if you want to get your question read out on next week's podcast to have a completely different topic actually answered, you should use a comment on YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube, let us know. It's a Commander Cookout question, or you can drop it in the Arsenal Pass Discord if you are a patron. Otherwise, you can tweet us. Jeet, as Brendan likes to say, on X. Email arsenalpassfab@gmail.com, whatever way you want to get in. Let's move into the main topic of the pod. And I don't know, I'm calling this the new faces of Flesh and Blood, the atypical decks. I don't know. There's a lot of rogue decks around in Flesh and Blood right now, and I think no more evident is this than in the last week. So I'm talking week two of ProQuest season. Week three has just happened, but we haven't seen the data yet by the time we record. But looking at the week two data and the anecdotal stories, and from even just from the deck list I'm seeing, and also the hero spread we're about to talk about, this is like crazy diversity. And we've had diversity in the past and people playing diversity, but we're seeing diversity win, and that is kind of crazy to me. And I think a big part of it is these rogue strategies, people coming with things that people don't know how to play into. They're winning because people don't, not only exclusively because people don't know how to play into their strategies, but that is definitely part of it. It is a big part of there just being so many more heroes than there were previously, but also I think a symptom of the fact that there's no true linear deck that's just doing a powerful aggressive thing in this format.
Yeah. So, do you think that's a win for design? Do you look at this diverse metagame, this diverse set of heroes that is winning ProQuest, and you're like, they did it, right? Because like this was something that they set out to achieve back when the deck was polarized by hyperlinear decks that were just default best decks, but also maybe one, you know, metagames that were composed of three decks. Now, this is a ProQuest metagame, so take it with a grain of salt. I still think like PT metagames are a bit smaller, but would you look at this and you're like, they did it. They accomplished their goal. This is a win. This is a better form of Flesh and Blood. Would Hayden Dale say that?
Would Hayden Dale say that? I don't know. It's different. It's personal opinion, I think, right? I think there's a few other factors in it than just is this diversity. Because I think the diversity is good. I will say, yes, the diversity is good. I think there's a lot of other factors happening in there with as to whether I think that this is the best format of all time or anything, or the best metagame. But I think the diversity, yeah, I think they set out to achieve that. They set out to have, you know, a change in the dynamic happening in the game. You know, think about things like ice. You think about things that had more linear power, I think, and maybe potentially even more consistency. And yeah, I think those, you know, those things have faded away. But again, you know, I'm really interested to see what happens in this next set. We've seen a lot of powerful cards. Like, I wouldn't be surprised to see the power level kind of spike a little bit more again. And we kind of go through these ebbs and flows of diversity, less diversity, diversity, less diversity. And I'm down with that. I'm down with having super open metas to somewhat more closed metas to open metas to. I think that's actually a really healthy kind of ebb and flow, because I think a closed meta that is balanced actually isn't closed at all. So it's more about, and we talked about information cascades last week, and if you haven't checked that pod out, recommend doing so. But I think they're actually metagames fit. You take that broad spectrum to metagames, not just specific decks. I think you can apply some of those same things. So it's complicated.
Do you think Flesh and Blood do you think Flesh and Blood is a game of polarizing matchups right now? Where if you pick a deck, you know, let's say the top five, maybe even the top 10, do you feel like when you enter a tournament, you have very polarizing matchups? Like you have things that you're genuinely trying to avoid, or do you like, what is your opinion on that?
Yeah, no, not at all. I think there's a couple of outliers to that. And I think Kano might be the ultimate.
Yeah, Kano's definitely one of them.
I think Kano might be just the best deck.
Oh yeah, we finally come around. It's like, so I was watching The Godfather recently, and I watched so long ago. Yeah, I actually forgot. And it's a fucking good movie. But I forget what he says. It's like I just don't remember the first line. It's like right as I leave, but it's like right as I come out, they pull me right back in, and like that's how I feel. Like I come here, it's like Prism's so popular, like fucking terrible deck, locks people out, and all this stuff, and then Hayden's on the pod the next week, and he's like, Kano just might be the best deck. I'm like, it pulls me right back in.
It's just because I think that it has polarizing matchups, and I don't think that other decks do right now. So, but anyway, yeah, to answer your question, I think no, I think that decks don't have very polarizing matchups, and I think that is kind of, yeah, I think it's less than people think. Like, I think there are some polarizing matchups. I think LSS like to think maybe that this meta is truly wide open. I don't think that's the case. I think there is tiers to decks. But, and like you say, you know, you head to a pro event, I think it's going to be a bit narrower. But you know what? We went to LA and it was still a pretty diverse meta. So, I don't know. Andromeda's gone. So, what does that mean? probably more diversity in theory.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the metagame from week two. So, you know, KO won the most events in week two of the ProQuest season, then Azalea, and then Prism. Okay, it feels like a fairly reasonable top three. Victor after that, and then Kasai. So pretty similar to some of the decks that we talked about when we talked about our not tier list, definitely not a tier list podcast 2 weeks ago, Brennan.
Yeah, and then you look down there. The dichotomy of the performance of that video versus like the fundamentals.
just clickbait a title on this one, it'll be fine. Yeah. And then Reinhardt, and then you get Kano, kind of the next two. But the craziest thing, right, is that there was 125 winners over week two of ProQuest. I just talked about KO being the number one, you know, winner, 12%. 12% of all wins came from KO. When was the last time you remember a ProQuest season or a national season where the quote-unquote best deck in the format was 12%, like that low?
So the thing is I don't remember the numbers, but I remember the pictures. So like I'd never seen a pie, because it's effectively a pie chart here, where the slices were so small.
Yep, with that many pictures on it.
Yeah, that's a lot of pictures.
Usually it's like they can't fit a picture.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you look at KO and it's small. Like usually, and just to help you put it in perspective, the top five heroes were just less than 50% of the wins in week two.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's pretty crazy. Usually, top five heroes would be 70-80%. And yes, people go, well, there's more heroes than there was previously. Yeah, there are more heroes, but there's still a lot of shit heroes out there. Yeah. And some of these shit heroes.
More heroes should not equal this. I mean, we've had a lot of heroes in Flesh and Blood before, and it has not looked like this. I mean.
Riptide won four ProQuest.
You could have a million heroes. Like the whole idea is that it coalesces to three or four or five of them. Like the actual number of heroes, I think, is irrelevant, unless you get into those like critical minimums where they're like, okay, there only is five heroes. So the top five is the five.
Yeah, of course. But we've moved beyond that long ago.
Yeah. I'm a small tangent.
It's not like it just happened this, you know, this season.
You piqued my interest. So Kano's the best deck. What kind of Kano player are you? Are you a pitch deck Kano player? Are you first cycle Kano player? Are you a mix of the both kind of Kano player? Because I've been seeing some. I got some pings. I went to a Discord. There's a Discord that maybe a team uses to prepare for events. And someone said, if you aren't playing Kano pitch deck, you better be. I was like, oh, interesting. So what kind
of- I think they said if you know how to play this deck, you should be playing it. It's the best deck in the format.
No, they said you better be pitch deck. That's what they said. They specifically said you better be pitch decking matchups. I was like, So what kind of Kano player are you? What is best?
Well, this is kind of you've gone straight to the point, which I think is fine, which is I think there's a lot of these strategies right now, which we're gonna kind of talk about some of the key rogue strategies right now that are really making waves. If you're out there thinking, okay, what are these strategies? What are these atypical kind of more rogue strategies that people are employing to win ProQuest on heroes that people wouldn't think would win as many ProQuest as they would? And yeah, okay, we can talk about Kano first. Pitch stacking Kano. This is something we saw we've seen this forever. I remember pitch stacking back in Arcane Rising. Like people have been doing this for a long time. Yeah. But I think the big shift we saw at PTLA was I actually think the top eight Kano pitch stacked in some of his matches. That's why his list looked a bit weird.
I'd have to revisit, but if I recall, his list wasn't like the all-in pitch stack kind of list. Like he was also...
No, he played defense reactions, all right.
Okay, I can't remember if he was playing as many as some of the others or if he was just playing a small
No. So I think he was doing a hybrid of some pitch stacking, some not. But basically, there's this, for those out there that maybe not have heard this, there's a school of thought now that is similar to the school of thought we've heard for a long time, which is that you can pitch stack, second cycle, the combo, and you can be any kind of Arcane Barrier or Oasis Respites or whatever because you set up this ultimate stack that doesn't matter. Like, they just don't have enough resource cards to be able to beat because you draw so many cards with your pitch stack, with tomes, etc. This is, again, it's not a new thing. People have been doing this for a long time, but I think the biggest change is that the format has slowed down and that there's decks that just can't really respond to this in an efficient way. You know, KO is actually quite susceptible to this, to be honest, especially if they're not, and then the other thing is if they're not prepared for it. This goes back to a classic Flesh and Blood sort of conundrum, you know, a dichotomy, as Brennan would say, which is that someone can timestamp that, our dichotomy can timestamp that, but this time I said it, which is that you don't know what you sit down across from. And now Kano is one of those decks. You know, it used to be the Dashes of the world, it used to be the Katsus of the world, it used to be the Guardians of the world, right? Are they going to fatigue me? Are they going to beat me down with pummels? And now Kano is this. Are they going to set up this kind of in-game pitch stack that is kind of inevitable? And if I don't have enough pressure, then I'm going to die to it. Or are they going to try and first cycle kill me and just wildfire combo me? But if I'm not set up with you know, enough, if I'm set up with all pressure and no sort of like spell void or whatever, because spell void does nothing against the pitch stack. But if you don't have the spell void, for instance, against the non-pitch stack, what's going to happen? Where am I going to land? And KO can be susceptible if it's not set up for the right plan, for instance. So, yeah, Kano. Am I, so back to your question, Brendan, am I a first cycler or am I a pitch stacker? I'm personally, I'm going to go straight in with that. I'm a first cycle player. I ain't pitch stacking.
Yeah.
But there's some merits to it, for sure. 100% there's some merits to it. It's powerful. Like, so, if you aren't prepared for it and you don't know how to beat it, I think it's very, very powerful.
I want to be clear, too. When I say, are you a pitch stacker or are you a first cycler? It's more around deck build, because every first cycle Kano deck is always also been a pitch stack deck. So if you face something like hyper blue, like I'm gonna block you out, put no pressure on kind of guardian, I have, you know, mm-hmm. I have
you do need to pitch stack.
Yeah, you would pitch stack. You always can pivot that game plan. The difference is that they're playing cards that would prevent you from first cycle killing, right? So like defense reactions, things that would literally prevent you from having that as a reasonable game plan, mm-hmm. because you can't like try to combo off on somebody, pop your storm striders, and then, you know, flip your random blue and it's a defense reaction. You can't do that. So that's the big difference. And they take that deck and they apply pitch stacking in more matchups than traditionally would have been done.
Literally almost every matchup.
Yes, literally almost every single matchup, from what I understand. Yeah. I'm definitely a hybrid player, but I think if we were to fall into categories, I would fall into the first cycle category. But also, I've just never looked at pitch stacking that way, because I tried that strategy. When we first were doing the Kano thing, mm-hmm. that was the first strategy. It was like, okay, ultra combo deck. Every card in here is replacement value. All we do is try to combo and we block out until it's guaranteed. But that was also in a Starvo.
There's too much damage.
Yeah, it's a Starvo metagame.
Starvo Chain Briar. Like, there's just too much damage in those formats.
And Prism.
The argument now is that you can do that because there's not enough damage in the format, right? You can actually, at 30 life, you can block out enough to get to the point where you get to your second cycle pretty consistent. It's not guaranteed, right? Like, KO can just kind of do the thing and whatever and kill you. But, like, you know, well, even, you know, a lot of decks can do that, but you can pretty consistently get to that second cycle is kind of the thought process. I mean, Prism has kind of, I think, paved the way for this, you know, ALS loop, whatever. Prism kind of doing its thing is being seen as the one of the boogeymen's of the format, right? Mm-hmm. And I think has been kind of leading the way. But, you know, I've got five other decks that I want to talk about that are kind of doing this kind of more atypical kind of somewhat combo-esque, somewhat kind of attacking a very specific angle, like the Kano pitch stack that we just talked about then.
Interesting. Interesting. Sounds like the kind of metagame that people would hate on Twitter, but that is actually fun to play.
Yes, I agree. I'm really upset I couldn't play ProQuest this season. Do you want to move on to the next one?
Mm-hmm.
I think Reinar semi-intimidate combo, going for like an all-in Reinar plan. So we've kind of seen the shift. You know, I think back to you saw this is when you started first, Brendan, you first maybe talked with myself and Dan, and or maybe when we brought Dan into the group, but this kind of Claws Reinar deck that came about during like the Crucible of War meta that kind of evolved. But that at the time was like Art of War, it was Blood Rush Bellow. Like, it just aimed to do these big Blood Rush Bellow Art of War turns. And I think we're heading back towards that again. We saw Pablo at the PT play like a very kind of all-in kind of block until he found a big quad intimidate turn, Savage Beatdowns, for instance, you know, nine of Barraging Beatdowns, Blood Rush Bellows, of course, Claw plan. And I think that plan is quite clearly back on the table. And I think, in fact, Dromai was a really bad matchup for you. But I think Dromai being gone now with this plan, I think this plan is pretty good and it's really powerful and it's some similar sort of thing. You basically, what these decks are doing, same with Kano, same with this Reinar deck, is going, okay, decks are trading value at the moment. Decks can trade 12 to like easily 12 to 15, 16 damage turn cycles. But it involves them doing a combination of defending and attacking. And if my deck just says, well, you don't get to defend efficiently because I'm not going to attack on these turns, or you don't get to attack efficiently on these turns because I'm going to defend, then you go around the outside of what these decks are trying to do. You don't engage in their value game. Think about Kasai with Valiant Dynamos, for instance. Well, if I don't attack into you every turn, you don't get Valiant Dynamo value. All these things, right? Or you play some defense reaction, some offensive cards. Well, I'm not going to give you value to your defensive cards. And so basically, you know, you're kind of attacking them by not letting them execute their plan. and also then just having this kind of linear kind of plan that does a thing, does a sort of mini combo, whatever. And Reinar is one that can do that as well with like these big Intimidate stacks.
Very interesting.
It's on the table, Bryn. It's on the table.
It's an interesting way to look at the metagame and try to break the paradigm, right? Because
yes,
you had these like very, very consistent value trading decks, and now you have people responding to that with combo. But Dromai was really gatekeeping all of that because Dromai was saying
it was.
Dromai was saying if you sit back and try to do something, I'm going to overwhelm you with a persistent board advantage, right? Persistent and increasing board advantage. And you're like, okay, yeah.
We could just call this episode "Don't Play the Value Game." Because I think that's what all these decks are trying to do is break the value paradigm. And I actually think it's a really good way to attack the meta for at least the rest of the ProQuest season. Probably even maybe into PC Amsterdam. I think we'll see how that goes.
That's the game. That's the Flesh and Blood that I miss is like the OG like Viscerai stuff. Like ultimately I think Viscerai moved away from like full combo and except into very, very specific matchups. But like those are the kind of strategies I really enjoy. And it's funny that Dromai was heralded as this like very constrictive, kind of like toxic deck and very polarizing. It took up massive amounts of like every deck sideboard. It was like, oh, we're all going to be so free once Dromai leaves. And then it's just not interactive combo decks.
On one hand, yes, we have to dedicate the spots. We're not free. And then on the other hand, yeah, we're free, but we have to deal with all this bullshit afterwards. Yeah. And look, I don't like value decks personally. So,
yeah.
I'm okay with it. Viscerai is also on the table. I think that's the third deck I want to talk about. So Viscerai has been winning some ProQuest. Viscerai OTK is definitely a thing that you can be doing with Sonata. What's it called? The new one? Oh,
I'm sorry. Arcanics. Sonata Arcanics.
No, the other one. I'm a little bit tired, so it's a bit of a struggle. But so with the six cost or the X cost one, and you can go find the auras. This is quite powerful now. You can set up these combos. So I don't have access to a PC in front of me to search the card, but someone will find it. Fantasia or some shit. I don't know. Someone's going to find it. but basically, OTK is definitely on the table. But also, so is equally, going back to my point earlier, what deck are they going to play? Viscerai just tempo is playable again because, yes, you don't have Rosetta Thorn, but you don't have ice to worry about. The format is slowed down a little bit. Attacking on two axes of a card, arcane damage and physical damage is really powerful. So Viscerai, I think, is actually pretty reasonable. And I've talked about this multiple times over the past couple of weeks, Brandon, but one of the highest win rates on Talishar is coming out of Viscerai right now. So, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. We talked about this on a recent pod. It makes sense. Viscerai has definitely waned in power level from its glory days. But
sure.
It does make sense. It does make sense. Like the entire Runeblade value prop, it's always been there, but I think it was overshadowed by ice and then things like Dromai and also it felt like Viscerai got neutered at one point. I'm surprised that it has come back, but I still think it's what made it fundamentally powerful before is still available. So, it coming back to the metagame post-Dromai, it kind of makes sense. I got to see it to believe it, though. I got to see it to believe it.
I'm not saying it's tier one.
Yeah.
But I think there is the Viscerai, this atypical strategies we're talking about right now. Rogue decks, Viscerai is one of them. I want to leave Dorinthia till last. So let's go to Max. We talked a little bit about Max last week. Saw Max show up a little bit over the past 2 weeks of ProQuest season. And Max is definitely a thing. Max, Nitro, Mechanoid combo, same sort of thing. Don't give them value. Have two sort of big damage turns and then into a Nitro, Mechanoid combo into a higher octane. Create a Nitro, Mechanoid into a higher octane combo turn is really powerful. You can easily push through, 5 to 10 damage on those two big turns, and then you can have a higher octane turn which can push through 30 plus damage. So, I think Max is definitely on the table when you're looking at these rogue kind of atypical decks. What you have to worry about is people are freeing up Cyborg slots post Dromai. Are they able to fit in hate, smashing performances, arc smashes, smashing good times, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, you're the Max guy. Hayden, that was Hayden's deck for
that's Matt Rogers.
Previous world championships. Yeah, I mean, Matt Rogers got caught holding the bag. He actually played it at the event, but you showed up to Barcelona ready to play Max Nitro. I mean, Chris Ioli played it too. Different play group, but did end up playing it. Actually did well with it as well.
He did.
Yeah. Interesting deck.
Boost Dash or Dash IO. So, you know, while we're talking about value decks, let's go the other end. These combo decks that are more set up patient-based decks, let's go the other way and talk about decks that just go pedal to the metal. The reason they don't necessarily give you value into these value decks is they don't care about blocking. They're just coming in for pure damage or big setup turns. So similar, they, you know, something like Reinar that has these big setup turns, Dash IO or even Boost Dash, like Dash Inventor Extraordinaire, can have these setup turns and also defend in between. So I think these are real. I think we've seen Dash IO have a little bit of success over the past couple of weeks, including at Battle Hardens, et cetera, as well. And I think Boost Dash, like honestly, like fat decking like a 70 card Boost Dash IE deck is not out of the question. So I think it's one that, and you know, maybe it's not the best version. Maybe it's not even the best form of Mechanologist to be looking at right now. Maybe that is something like Max, but I think Mech's not getting a lot of love right now. And I think if I was going to look at it, I think these kind of fringe decks we're seeing that are just Dash IO or Dash IE that are Boost, I think are most of interest.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk about those Dorinthia decks. I mean, where do you think that these lie, especially like, it's always very interesting to me, the dichotomy, see, I can say it too, of Warriors between Kasai, Dorinthia, and of course Bolton. I've been seeing the Boltons floating around as Bolton's well. But do you think that these Dorinthia strategies are more powerful than, like, where does Kasai land now post Dromai? Like, what are your thoughts on it? Because this is one of those decks you were super high on before.
I think we've had the conversation about like Dorinthia versus Kasai. If you're going to play single-handed weapons, you're going to play two weapons, just play Kasai. I think it's just a much better deck than Hatch's Dory. But I think Dawnblade Dorinthia is actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. And I think you can build an attack. Unified Decree might be in play, Brendan. You can build these more attack reaction based decks and really take advantage of the fact of counters, because yes, there are decks out there that do want to defend, but they don't all play enough defense reactions to actually be able to combat your ability to stack counters. So I think Dawnblade Dorinthia potentially with like a change up to a Decimator kind of sideboard is really powerful for the fact that your number one game plan could just be Dorinthia counter stacking aggressive deck.
Yeah. Very nice. I know somebody who played that at the Pro Tour, actually played a similar version. He did quite well. Mr. Nick Butcher.
Yeah.
Only person in the entire play group to play Dorinthia, by the way.
I think he played a ProQuest the other day and went 8-0 or 9-0 or something as well on the deck. So he's still playing it. I mean, that's kind of my view right now. I just think, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about tier lists and decks to play and what's kind of where in terms of the ProQuest. Sorry, not a tier list, you know what I mean, in the ProQuest season. But I think also the diversity is crazy. You know, five decks, less than 50% of the meta last week in win share. The top deck, 12% only meta share. Like, that is just a win share. Sorry, that is crazy, right? We've never really seen this before. And these kind of atypical strategies are really making waves. It started with Prism a couple of weeks ago, but it's you know, it's gone even further. It's the Kano pitch stackers of the world, like we just talked about. It's the Reinar Intimidates. I mean, Reinar was like, you know, sixth most winningest deck last week, ProQuest season two. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, let me ask you. Let me come full circle. What about KO? What does this mean for?
It's just still good. It still is the best deck. It's just consistent. It's just good, but it's not 10% or 15% better than a lot of other things. It's 2.5 to 5 to maybe 7.5% better than other things. And it has some bad matchups. It has some targets on it, and decks that want to play an asymmetric game plan that don't necessarily want to trade value and can have these big setups. So the Kano pitch stacks of the world, maybe the Reinar combos of the world, whatever, can do really well into these kind of decks like KO and Kasai, and even Victor, which may be three of the best decks in the format right now. It's great. I think it's a really healthy balance, honestly.
Yeah.
Except maybe Kano. The Kano might just be really good. Like, the fact that Kano can do both things and do it really well and also just be inherently powerful.
Yeah, but it's like crazy. It is fucking hard to pitch deck like that. Like literally from turn one, like that. That is a hard. It is hard to do. Like I think there's a lot of players that will tell. Yes, I think a lot of players will tell you it's easy, but it is no. It's genuinely challenging. It is genuinely.
It's hard to do if it gets like people posing disruption at you. I would say if you get to goldfish and solitaire, and often you do because I think people haven't been as aware of the strategy. But you know, if you play against a good player who kind of knows what's going on and can throw some disruption your way or find the turn to kind of ruin your pitch deck by forcing you to have to like block with your hand when they know you're coming back to your pitch deck or whatever it is, it can actually be devastating. I do agree.
Yeah, I also don't know the math on like how many resources they need to do whatever they're doing, whether it's double wildfire or like what it is, but I'm assuming it's more than three energy potions. So they're also stacking. I'm assuming that they're also stacking Tome Double Blue.
You have to stack Tomes, yeah.
Okay, so that it's kind of hard to do. Like I think that it gets undersold, like how challenging it can be. Like any blip, like a disruption, can really screw you over.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, and you can definitely just lose to your like how the first cycle comes out as well. If people are putting enough pressure and good pressure on you, but. Look, I'm not saying it's like it's infallible. I'm just saying I think it is quite powerful, and because I already think Kano is powerful, to also have access to this kind of strategy, I think is quite good. But look, if someone said, you know, gun to my head, best deck in the format right now, it's still KO. It's KO or Kasai, I think.
Yeah, I mean that takes us back to reality. Like, how are these Kanos doing in the Prism in particular? As Prism is the third most winning.
Can tell you, probably it's terrible. Probably terrible. They're probably dead, but who cares?
Give me whatever. I want to smoke whatever these guys are smoking to dodge these prisms. I've not been on that in my recent events.
You just gotta have faith. Gotta have faith.
Well, anyway.
Urban, you wanna take us out?
Yeah. If you enjoy this podcast, then what they can do is leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. The video version of this on YouTube at youtube.com/ArsenalPass. Don't forget to get your Command and Cookout questions in. Deck techs for the ProQuest season still up. We have Kasai and Kao, two techs Aiden just said were the best techs in the format. And of course, they have their additional pieces on Patreon if you're interested in them. And you can also find that Rhino deck talk there as well. And the support helps us a lot. Thank y'all so much for listening. Yeah. We will see you next week.
Okay, back in person, back in the recording booth.
Back in the recording booth, sitting right next to me, right here. All right, see y'all.